asleep. Rise to a new day with each your soul to keep. Come, my children, time to awake from your sleep. Rise to a new day with each your soul to keep.
Hello, and welcome to the Enlightened Medicine Show with Dr. Valerie Olmsted, the holographic physician. Before we get started with tonight's guest, let me mention that the show is brought to you by Hydramay Skin Nutrition. And if you haven't tried it yet, what are you waiting for? It is amazing stuff, and it's very affordable. And that's not the only thing that I use, and it's pure and natural for your skin. Okay, let's get to our guest for tonight, who is Dr. Mark Seifer. Hello, how are you doing, Mark?
Good, very well.
Excellent. I just finished reading your book, Transcending the Speed of Light. And I don't know if I'm going to be able to ask you really good questions. You may just have to talk for an hour. There are so many things in here. This could take really several shows to go through, I think. But it's quite a work, and I think that the listeners are going to have quite a few things to think about. So welcome to the show. And
okay,
if you would, could you go ahead and give a bio? You know, how did you get to writing this book and doing all this quantum physics stuff from being a handwriting expert and a psychologist?
Well, after I graduated college, I graduated in 1970. I moved back to New York where I grew up, and I studied handwriting analysis at the New School for Social Research. But I was also very interested in dreams. And Dr. Stanley Krippner had a dream laboratory in Brooklyn, Maimonides Dream Laboratory, and he was doing studies on dream telepathy. And in fact, he wrote a book by that title with two other authors. It's called Dream Telepathy. And he had senders and receivers, so when someone was sleeping and they were in the REM cycle, there would be someone else looking at various pictures in another room or another building, and they would try to transmit these pictures to the dreamer, and the hits were amazing. So I wanted to study with Dr. Krippner. So I went to Maimonides, and I found out he had left the school, and he had moved to California, and he was teaching at Saybrook Institute. So I'd gotten a master's degree at this point at the University of Chicago. And then I went out to San Francisco, and it's a school without walls, so I spent some time out there. I mostly lived in Rhode Island, and I studied with Dr. Krippner. And I got interested in the inventor, Nikola Tesla, and wrote a biography on Tesla called Wizard. But at the same time, during that period, I did some research on the idea of precognition, synchronicity, meaningful coincidences, and the structure of time. And Dr. Krippner was my mentor. So that was the seeds of this book. When I got back to Rhode Island in the mid-1970s, I started to teach courses in parapsychology. My main textbook at the time was Psychic Explorations, which was written by Edgar Mitchell and John White. They were actually the editors, and there were many authors. Krippner was one of the authors, and there's about 20 authors, different chapters on telepathy, clairvoyance, out-of-body experiences. And on,
yeah, I had that book.
It's a superb book. I think they should put it back in print. And I had a journal at the time called MetaScience, so I would attend various conferences, and one of the most amazing conferences I attended in the late 1970s was the Physics of Consciousness Conference, which was held at Harvard University. And Andrea Puharich was there, Tom Bearden was there, and Bell was there. There were other people. And so I wrote a big article on basically quantum physics and consciousness, and that was the seeds of all this. And then I started to teach parapsychology. I taught it at Providence College for 15 years. I edited a journal. I interviewed many psychics and super psychics. I became good friends with Uri Geller. I spent a little bit of time with Ingo Swann, Matthew Manning, Dean Kraft. These are all healers, people out-of-body experiences. Geller could bend metal, and he did ESP. And so that was the seeds of all of this. And at some point, I befriended a physicist at Providence College. His name was Dr. Edwin Gorer. Gorer was an amazing man. He was already in his 70s when I met him. He was half German and half Polish, and his mentor was Werner Heisenberg. And Heisenberg and Einstein are probably the two most important physicists of the 20th century. But the weird thing was that Heisenberg was in charge of the nuclear bomb for Adolf Hitler, and Gora was a doctoral student in Nazi Germany at the time. Because he was half Polish, and they had obviously invaded Poland, he was a threat, and the Gestapo had picked him up, and Heisenberg was helpful in saving his life, and Gora had no idea that he was involved in the nuclear bomb, that Heisenberg was. But Gora eventually came to Providence College, and so he was an older man when I met him, and he attended some of my courses, and we became good friends. So from him, I learned a lot of physics and quantum physics, and the very beginning of the book, Transcending the Speed of Light, has a lot of the stuff that he wrote. He had written an article for the journal that I produced, and he was working on part two, and he was working on it for almost 10 years, and he passed away before it was finished. But I used sections from this article that he wrote, and I obviously quoted him at length in those sections. So that was really the seeds of how this book began.
I find myself fascinated by the way you wove all this stuff together. There's so much information in this book that is so important to the field of quantum physics and helping the rest of us understand that. And your subtitle of Consciousness, Quantum Physics, and the Fifth Dimension is something that we on this particular radio station are very interested in. There are so many people who are really on that edge of realizing that we are moving into a new dimension. And so I think that this book kind of, first of all, it gives a lot of history, which is not easily found. And so it was valuable for that, for me, and for anybody that wants to do any research on the development of quantum physics and the mind, the non-local mind. And I've had quite a few physicists on throughout the years that have talked about that. And so I find it fascinating that from your background, you just kind of happened into all these physicists and mathematicians and people that you wouldn't really expect for most normal people that went through the programs that you went through to kind of run into. So I think that this is something that that can be quite valuable for a lot of people, and I'm going to try to bring some of the points out that you put in the book and have you explain them a little bit more in layperson language for the audience. So if you don't mind, I'd like to start with a quote from Bentov about different resonant frequencies in the cavities of the brain, and you were talking about sonics used by the brain for intracortical information exchanges and about the pituitary and pineal communicating with each other across the third cavity of the brain.
Well, he was an amazing man, Isaac Bentov, and in fact he died in a very famous plane crash. Howard Hunt's wife was on board that plane after the Watergate situation. And he wrote, the famous book, Stalking the Wild Pendulum, and he had spoken at this Harvard conference. One of the things I talk about, and one of the great mysteries about our mind, is the way we perceive. When you look out at the world, you see a world outside of your body. So maybe you're obviously in a room right now, and I'm in a room, there's a chair in the room, there's a picture on the wall, there's lights, and there's a television in the room. And all those things appear outside my body. But the truth of the matter is the image has to be created inside our brain, inside our eye, and then inside our brain. So we've got something called inner space. And so one of the points of the book is it's a real attempt to try and explain or try to get physicists to understand that they've got to consider inner space. Just like there's outer space, there's inner space, which is mental space or hyperspace. So one idea is that it's in a sense a hologram. We're creating a three-dimensional image that appears, looks like it's outside our head, and it really is outside our head, but in the actual image is appearing inside. So in some type of way, we're projecting that image back outside. Now, Bentoff was talking about the link between the pineal gland and the pituitary and different resonant frequencies. And there's a crossover there between, I have a section in the book on holography and holographic brain theory, and that is, how does holography work? How does three-dimensional photography work? And is there a link between the way three-dimensional photography works, holography, and the way that we perceive? And I think some of the standing waveforms that Bentoff is talking about, the interaction of the different glands and the different brain cavities, is all linked to this. So I'm looking at it from that point of view.
Well, I find it fascinating because for a long time, those of us that have been into metaphysics and spiritual communication have talked about getting downloads. And, I mean, I've had some downloads that were so heavy I about slid off of the couch I was sitting on because the information was coming in so fast and heavy. And when I was reading that section in your book, all of a sudden everything started clicking in about how the communication is coming through the right side of the brain and speeding across through that central area or maybe through that cavity and then translated so that the left side of the brain can understand it and bring it into the consciousness. That was just fabulous that was in there and explained so much for so many of us, I think, because I don't know anybody in my circle of friends that hasn't had that experience of the high-pitched sound and not knowing quite what it meant, but having it be so high-pitched and so insistent that it pretty much knocks out all other thought and that you can't do anything until you lay down and just let it happen.
Mm-hmm. In a sense, we're vessels.
Yeah.
I have a little section in the book on time and space and its link to the brain. I tried to study a lot of scientists and footnote everything so people know where my ideas came from. And one of the people that I studied was Alexander Luria. He's Luria. I think he's probably the most important neurophysiologist of the 20th century. He's a Russian. And he talked about that the right brain perceives with something called simultaneous synthesis. In other words, it sees the whole, and the left brain sees the parts. And I had, I think, just a mini revelation. You know, I get some of them. There's a few revelations, I think, in the book. But I thought simultaneous synthesis is space, a spatial concept, and seeing the parts is more a time concept. So you see things, you know, linear. The left brain is more linear, and the right brain is more spatial, intuitive and spatial. So I thought, well, maybe the left brain is more linked to time, and the right brain is linked more to space. And as you're talking, can you kind of translate what I'm saying into what you were just saying? You pick up something one way, and then you translate it into something else across that, you know, the corpus callosum or whatever. So you've got data coming in two different ways in the brain. Some people are more space type people, some people are more time type, or some people are more left brain types, and some people are more right brain types.
Oh, absolutely, and I think. Having it come across the commissures and being translated is a concept that I think is fairly new. And I mean, the whole idea of it, I think this helps people to understand the makeup of the human being a lot better, because it's one thing to have the physicist say to you that, you know, everything is occurring inside your brain and you're creating all this outside and the eyes are the projectors. That's one thing to say it, but nobody really gets it. But I think what you did in your book is you really pulled that together nicely, especially with the quotes from Bentoff and Floyd and Bearden. And let me quote just for a minute here. The quote from Floyd about the pineal body occupies the midpoint at the center of a neural energy field, at which point occurs the burst of light that is experienced holographically as the screen of consciousness. Now, this is explaining something a little bit deeper than most of the information on the holographic mind that's out there. So I thought that was really valuable. And also the quote from Bearden about the photons operating in a dimension one greater than our physical world, and that realm is isomorphic or coalescent with the realm of our consciousness. This is astounding. I don't think I've read that anyplace else. And I love the way that you pulled that together.
Yeah, I mean, there's just, I found that quote about the pineal gland and Freud's concept. You know, Tesla was an inventor, and when he came up with this idea of the alternating current, he had his third eye opened up. And, you know, and the question is the third eye would be the pineal gland, you know, or maybe that's the fourth eye. Maybe the pituitary is the third, but the whole idea of the pineal gland has an input pathway through the eye. It receives light. That's how it gets its energy. It actually receives light through the eye, and it triggers the pineal gland. And I had one instance in my life where I had the third eye actually open up. It was an amazing experience, and I felt like a coal miner. You know, with the headlight coming off the forehead? Honestly and truly, it happened only once in my life. And I met a yogi master, and I told him about it. And he basically said that I was a child in this, that I was, you know, I was a neophyte. I was just, you know, this one thing. And that's what's, you know, some of these psychic experiences, maybe it's the one time in your life, that's it. Maybe it never happens again. But it's so profound that you never forget it. And I certainly have never forgotten it. And so having had that experience, I wanted to put that in the book because I thought, you know, the quotes that you just read, because there's something very important there. I mean, Aristotle thought the soul was linked to the pineal gland. I mean, there's some huge secret with the pineal gland. One thing I did not put in the book, which I wanted to do, and I just didn't get around to doing it, is how we tan. You know, sun hits our skin and changes our skin, and we absorb vitamin D, you know, through the sun. What is that all about? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Absorbing a vitamin from the sun. That was one little tidbit I didn't put in, but I did put in the idea that the pineal gland has an input pathway with light. So there's some huge secret with light, and that's why I added the section on Royal Rife and the cancer research. Did you cover that area when you looked through the book, or would you like me to talk a little bit about
that? I read the whole thing front to back, and I pulled out the things that that I wanted the audience to really get, you know, because this is something that is right now opening up people's consciousness to more. And so I'm thrilled with this whole thing. And yes, light is so important, and the frequencies of light. And I myself deal with frequencies quite a bit, and I've been doing experiments with that with some quantum physics equipment. And opening to other dimensions and portals and having communication with other beings. And so it's been, you know, really interesting to see how all this comes together. And when Royal Rife did his thing with his amazing microscope, I think you actually put down how many parts were in there. I don't remember how many parts, but it was something astounding. Wasn't it thousands of parts?
I think it's 6,000 parts, I think it had.
Yeah, that's amazing. I've never actually seen a Rife microscope, but I, you know, of course, I know about it being a naturopathic physician. But it was just really amazing. First of all, that this guy realized that it was the frequency of light and the resonance of that whole thing about it's kind of like you know, the old Memorex commercial. You know,
yeah.
Of hitting the high note and then the glass shattering, and doing the same thing with bacteria and viruses by finding their light frequency. So, yeah, fascinating stuff. And
you know,
the other
thing.
Go ahead,
yeah.
Sorry.
Well, one of the things that I question, I mean, I've been. This book is 30 something years of research. Rife's work is so fundamental, and in physics, we find out that all matter is held together by the sharing of photons. Light particles hold all of that matter together, and every different bacteria, every virus would have its own resonant frequency. And we know, you know, that like you said, the Memorex commercial, when you hit the resonant frequency, you can destroy this. It's so fundamental. I don't understand why there is resistance in this country to doing research on Royal Rife. I don't understand why there's resistance in studying telepathy. We all know that we have, you know, this ability. Everyone sees, you know, X-Men and all those kinds of movies. They earn billions and billions of dollars. We know we have these abilities. And that's the question I'd like to ask you. I mean, why do you think there is so much resistance to me, things that are so clear and about our abilities and about these scientific findings?
I can tell you why. Because it would upset the apple cart of big pharma, big medicine, and big food. And that's not even to mention the people that own the world and the bad guys that are around and everything else. And as someone who has had the black helicopter come after me and irradiate me and you know, basically try to kill me, I can tell you that there's a lot of resistance to these things because it's waking people up. And when you wake up the masses, there's a lot more of us than there are of the bad guys. So when that happens, and if we are tapped into our full powers, then we become like the angels. And they no longer have any means of controlling us, because then we're in the same realm, the same vibratory realm, the same dimension, whatever. You know, you talk in your book about tapping into the higher dimensions by raising your vibratory rate, and that's really what it is. And I can tell you many times that I've raised my vibratory rate and just done amazing things and experienced amazing things. And I get to hang around with people that have likewise had those experiences. So I think the resistance is there, first of all, to wake us up and to make us really more cognizant of the fact that we are more. And so people are waking up more, which is really encouraging. And the way that they wake up is when people like you write these kinds of books and people like me find you and say, hey, come on the show and tell us all about this, because this is really vital information. This is stuff that's pointing the way to how we get back to who we really are, you know, that we become these higher vibratory beings that we were always meant to be and were prevented from being. So, yeah, amazing stuff.
I have a little bit of Gurdjieff stuff in there, but I have a lot of Uspensky in there. And Gurdjieff talks about something he calls the Kunda buffer. We have Kundalini energy in that, you know, the fall of man, that there's been a buffer placed on our Kasics or on our Kundalini energy, because we've, in a sense, you know, fell from grace. So we're trying to remove the Kunda buffer. We're trying to reach back to enlightenment. In an earlier book that I wrote, which I use as a textbook when I teach psychology, I have a whole section on dreams, and I have studied Freud's work, you know, at great length. And I think when you really understand Freud, he's a brilliant theoretician in trying to discuss the unconscious. But as an evolving person, I've rethought about dreams. In fact, in a sense, I struggle with it, because I think Freud is right. I think a lot of our dreams are problems that we have, working out our problems and psychoanalytic stuff. But I think other dreams are out-of-body or soul journeys to other places. I just had a dream last night, you know, and I was with a high school buddy of mine in the dream, and we were underwater, and there was all these gravestones, and there was all this Hebrew writing on all the gravestones. And, you know, and why do I dream of this fellow? I don't know. You know, he's a kid I grew up with. I haven't seen him in, well, I actually saw him a couple of years ago at a reunion. But the dream, the feeling of the dream, it doesn't feel like I'm working out a problem with my wife or my boss or this or that. It's not that kind of thing at all. It's a journey. It's a, you know, it's more of a Jungian kind of a thing, this journey that you take. So I feel like I address it in this book, you know, that I think our dream world is very, very important for humans to get to this next level and to realize that dreams are multidimensional. They operate on different levels, and one level is exactly what Freud is saying, working out our problems. But another level, if you break through to this other level, they're journeys. You interact with dead people. I have dreams all the time with people that have passed away. And
yeah, me too.
You know, the gut feeling is you're really interacting with these people. You know, they're there. It's not wish fulfillment. You hope that they're alive, because you don't go to sleep saying, "Geez, I hope I don't dream of this person." You go to sleep, and then these things happen to you. You know, so I don't think Freud's wish fulfillment theory holds for so many things. And to me, I think one of the biggest keys is the idea of lucid dreaming, is to try and bring some level of awareness, self-awareness, into that realm, because I think that everything that you're talking about, the higher beings and all of that, that's our portal. That is our way to reach these higher entities. But it's not easy, because, well, if it was easy, we would all be able to do it. Mm-hmm. There's something holding us back. But so I keep a dream diary. I mean, I write down, I've got, you know, 15, 20 years of my dreams written down in different journals and stuff. And I tell your listeners that I think it's very important to have this dialogue with this other self, because that's our higher self, you know. One of the things I mentioned in the book is we're hundreds of thousands, probably millions of years old in terms of evolution and whatever. And this Mark, me, Mark Seifer, this guy who's, you know, sitting here talking to you, is just, you know, the top of this giant iceberg. But the iceberg's hundreds of thousands of years old, and that's our unconscious. And that thing talks to us in dreams. It's interacting with the outer us. So there's two of you. I like Lapsang Rampa's term of the oversoul. I just like the word. I like the term oversoul, because it connotes something very different than you know, the Freudian unconscious. Because there's something wiser than you or me, in a sense, in this deeper self that we all have, that all humans have.
I totally agree. And I had a teacher who was really wonderful, Torkum Seridarian, and he used to talk about the astral and our dream world, and how part of our job was to recognize that we do live in these other dimensions. And I've gotten to the point now where I am living a full life. At least three nights out of the week, I'm in this other dimension, which, by the way, is a heck of a lot nicer than this one. But and, you know, I'm ready for when that window opens and we go cross over into the higher dimension. And really, the physicists say that we can communicate with the ones that have passed over during our dream state very easily, because then we cross into those other dimensions, and that the spirit or the energy of that person has not left the earth. It's still here. It's just in another dimension, and we can't really see them. Although, I have to tell you, when my late husband passed away 3 days later, he came and laid down on the bed next to me and dented the bed. And wow. I knew it was him, and I looked, and I couldn't see him. But I reached out, and I touched him, and he felt solid to my hand, but I couldn't see him at all. He was completely see-through. I could hear him. And I know quite a few other people have had that kind of an experience. And so you know that there is some kind of dimensional overlay that does happen with us now and then, and we're able to actually tap into that. And I know plenty of people have done it through hypnosis and through meditative practices, you know, opening the third eye and allowing the self to relax enough, getting the brain into that alpha state where we do have the intuition and we have the relaxation and we are able to connect. But really, we're connected all the time through the subconscious. We just don't realize it.
Yeah, I agree. When my father passed away, I didn't have it as dramatic as you, but it was, I sat down on the couch with him. He put his arm around me and we talked. Mm-hmm. And then I spoke to my sister, and she had almost the same exact dream. And that was very comforting. I remember, you know, when he passed away, I was speaking to Uri Geller, and he said, he's in a better place. I'd never heard anybody ever say that before. I guess it's said all the time, but no one had ever said that to me. And I thought, wow, what a heavy thought it is. So simple, but really so profound. That there are these, you know, these other realms that are better.
Absolutely.
I kid about it, though, because I say, you know, if we are immortal, then we've lived before. And if we've lived before, then this is heaven.
Well, heaven as far as we know it. But if you've ever talked with people that have been through the other heavens, and, well, as far as we can go without going poof, it's one of the, you talk in your book about how anyone who has experienced these higher dimensions can't even start to describe God. And it's true. You know, I've been there, done that. You can't describe that one because it's all of us. And yet people can't understand when you speak of that, how could that be? Because we are all separate. But the truth is we're really all connected. We always have been and we always will be. But we have to go play this game. So I kind of look at it like God's little video game, you know, and God can compartmentalize it, its great mind into these little places where it doesn't go and look to discover itself completely. It lets the parts discover itself. And it's kind of fun. And, you know, having been on the other side several times myself near death, I can also tell you that you know, when you're on the other side, this is easy. You look down at the earth and go, eh, you know, put me back in. Maybe I can help. And then you get back in the body and go, oh, crap. I was out there in unconditional love and with all the ones that I love that have passed on and with Jesus himself and with the angels, and I chose to come back to the prison. But, you know, it's a video game, and the challenge is what it's all about. You know, it helps us to grow. It helps us to become more. And I love reading your book because this really helped me to put some of my experiences into the scientific realm to be able to explain it better. Like when you start talking about the scalar component and gravity and zero-point energy and transcending the speed of light, and that information goes faster than the speed of light. And I forget how many times faster you said, you know, pardon me on that, but I know it was astronomically faster than the speed of light, which everybody thinks is the fastest. And this is amazing stuff, Mark.
There's a lot there. One of the people that I read as a kid was George Gamow, G-A-M-O-W, and he was one of the founders of quantum physics. And he wrote a book called 30 Years That Shook Physics, and he lived it. He was with Einstein and Bohr and Heisenberg and all these people as they're developing their theories. And he said that electrons spun at 1.37 times the speed of light. In other words, faster than the speed of light. And this was a measurement that Goudsmit and Uhlenbeck had created, and it violated relativity. And one of the things I try to do is I try to look at Einstein's theory in a more critical way. I think that there's problems with his theory because he says nothing can travel faster than the speed of light, and yet the physicists have found electrons spinning faster than the speed of light. So Dirac came along, and he said, well, let's call this spin the square root of negative 1. Let's call it an imaginary number. And so if we call it the square root of negative 1, then we don't have to deal with the fact that it's spinning faster than the speed of light. And he was therefore able to combine Einstein's theory with quantum physics, and he got a Nobel Prize. Now, I got on Google, which is one of the amazing things. Google is faster on the whole Internet than my search engine is on my computer. And I try to find this study about 1.37 times speed of light. There's almost nothing on the Internet on it. And yet here is Gamow writing about it. I think this is a huge door opener for physicists because it proves that something is traveling faster than the speed of light because they've measured it. And what I'm guessing and what I explain in the book is that what gravity is, it's the absorption of ether so that the particles that the matter is made of, you know, let's say the Earth is made up of matter, it has particles, electrons and protons, that make up the physical part of the planet. They're absorbing ether all the time. That's what gravity is. So when you jump up, you're drawn back to the Earth because you're in the way of this influx. And this energy is keeping the particles spinning and then being transformed into electromagnetic energy. That is what Einstein's dream was grand unification. How do you combine gravity with electromagnetism? Once you understand it, it's a very simple idea. But you have to see through that there's a problem with Einstein's theory of relativity. The reason why he couldn't create grand unification was it would have been at the cost of his theory of relativity. So the entire 20th century has evolved ignoring the fact that we know that electrons are spinning faster than the speed of light, and that therefore his theory can't be totally correct. The other thing which I realized in writing the book is that the physical universe is bound by the speed of light, but our mind isn't. How else could change take place? If everything was bound by the speed of light, we'd all be just caught in the mechanical action of the Earth going around the sun, going around the galaxy, going around the universe. How does change take place? The only way change can take place is if something is transcending all that, which is living in a dimension that is not, has nothing to do with that process. So in a sense, our mind, in a sense, is at right angles to the physical universe. We're just in a totally different dimension. And I think that was a profound realization that came out of the writing, the process of writing the book, to realize that the only way change could take place is if indeed our mind did transcend the speed of light, because if it didn't, we would just simply be caught up in the mechanical action of the process of the way the universe simply, all the planets revolve around each other. One of the other things you said, which really hit me, no one can explain God. Inner Traditions did a tremendous job of putting all the pictures I wanted in it. I wanted a beautiful picture of a galaxy, and I chose a picture of a spiral galaxy. I want people to look at that galaxy, just to look at the photograph. And that there's hundreds of billions of galaxies. How could we possibly comprehend God or the universe? We can't even comprehend one galaxy, let alone hundreds of billions of galaxies. We're just one little star inside one of these things. I mean, so it's so vast, so tremendously vast. And I think the physicists are a bit egocentric, to leave the mind out, to leave out this giant mysterious element, which I'm trying very hard to put back in, to say, you physicists, if you really want to create a full model for the space-time continuum, you must include the mind. You have to include this mental space, this inner space. You can't create a full model without it. I think that's really the main thing I'm trying to do when I put the book together.
Well, and it makes perfectly good sense, too, because the mind has been shown by some physicists to be non-local. Like, when you were talking about Pribram and Puharich and all of these physicists that have really broken ground, it reminds me of conversations I've had with a physicist friend of mine, Rick Miller, who worked for the Navy and, doing paranormal research and knew a lot of these people. And he was talking about the non-local mind and about how the mind doesn't exist anywhere within the brain. The brain's just basically a kind of an antenna.
Yeah.
And talking about space-time and all these different dimensions and everything, it makes a heck of a lot more sense to me than the old Newtonian physics ever did. And, this kind of stuff, the quantum physics, it's so inherent, I think, within who we are, that I think a lot of people understand quantum physics better than they ever understood the Newtonian method, because that other stuff was all math, and, you don't really have to do math to understand how quantum physics really works, because we are it. Without sounding, like I'm totally crazy, let me just say that I have seen flashes of amazing, miraculous insight come through people in a blinding flash. You can actually see the flash happen off of that person, and you kind of do a double take. And I look at it as a download, but where did it come from? It did not come from within their brain. It came from outside. It came from the ethers, as you say.
Well,
and
I think that there are certain artists who raise our consciousness. I think, for instance, I think Spielberg is a mixed bag, but I think E.T. and Close Encounters, I think when he made those films, he in a sense was a vehicle, because they raise your consciousness. You see those films, and your consciousness is raised. And in a sense, he's acting as an antenna. And I think most great artists, you go just to, the Louvre or any Metropolitan Museum, and you look at a great work of art, and if you become enlightened, if you're raised up because of what you see, we watch Antiques Roadshow, and there was a vase on, it was last night, and I said to Lois, I said, $40,000. I said, this vase is worth $40,000. I never heard of the artist, but I just looked at it, So she describes the thing, and she says, this vase is worth between 60 and 80,000. I mean, you could just see it. It was a masterful work of art, and you could just see that immediately you see what a great work of art. So I think the artist is definitely doing exactly what you're saying. They're receiving these impulses. You've been able to actually see the flash. I've seen auras, and I've seen, I wrote a little bit about it in the book. Elwood Babbitt was a medium. I don't know if he's still on the planet. He probably isn't. But when I saw him speak, I saw literally a helmet of light around his whole head. I mean, it was, it looked like he was wearing a helmet of light. And I was like tapping people around me saying, do you see the helmet of light around this guy's head? So he was definitely, I mean, he was just this huge antenna. And I always felt, you know, if Jesus came back to the earth, he would just know it. I mean, he would just walk down the block and he would just know it. There would be no doubt, because he would be just a glowing, shining being. You know, you certainly have been fortunate to have seen these things a number of times.
Oh, yeah, and I can tell you that when I first saw Jesus, I was out of my body at the time. I was meditating, came out of the body, and there he was, and I fell to my knees. I mean, it was he was so brilliant, you couldn't look at him. And all I felt from that great being was just this just indescribable, complete love and no judgment whatsoever. And I was so shocked, I jumped back into the body, and I opened my physical eyes and looked around, and it was all dark, and because it was the middle of the night. And so I closed my eyes, opened up my third eye, jumped out of the body again. There he was, you know, and I did that a couple times because I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I mean, it was just amazing. And the whole feeling of that being was just indescribable. And when I got up in the morning, everything electronic in the house that had been pretty much toast was suddenly working. And the roommates in the house had seen this brilliant light streaming out, lighting up the entire hallway and all the way upstairs. And they asked me if I had every light in the house on and why. And I said, no, I was just meditating. And it really is light. And I mean, just amazing. And when you start to think that that's what we are, and yet somehow we dim down our light and we come into these fleshy computers and we go through this existence really to discover ourselves and to grow up enough to really be let out into the universe so we don't destroy other beings. But, I mean, the whole way that this is set up gives you even a tiny hint of what the mind of God itself is to have created something this incredible. This did not happen by chance. I mean,
I was really happy when the artist came up with the cover for the book, just this pulse of light, which is exactly what you're saying. And one of my favorite etchings, which I actually own, is Jesus in the Temple, which is on page 26. I just love that picture, and it's worth meditating on. I identify with the guy to the left of Jesus. He's staring at the head rabbi, and there are one, two, three. There are four rabbis, and Judas is in the background. And Jesus, you can see the cross, you know, through he's radiating a cross around his head, and he's pointing to the Bible. And all of these rabbis are looking at him, trying to figure, geez, maybe this guy really is the real deal. And the depth of the Heinz Hoffman is the guy who did it in the 1800s. There's just so much there, and I think very much that that's, I think that's pretty much what happened. But you had this amazing fellow, 2,000 years ago, and then there were factions split off. You know, one group believed in him, and another group didn't, and then, well, you know, the bad things happened to him as well. But I'm tapped into the good stuff. I never saw the Mel Gibson movie. I'm not into the suffering part of it. I'm more into
I didn't see it either.
I'm into the enlightenment part. You know that what he stands for. You know, that he raises our consciousness, and I also have a little section on that same page of from Rudolf Steiner. The name of God is I am. I am that I am. And what Steiner says is that the word I is a very unusual word, because you can only say I for yourself. You can't say it for someone else. So I could say Valerie said this, or she said that, or you said that, but I can't say I said that for you. So the only way you can say that word is if you're talking about yourself, and if the name of God is I Am, that immediately gives us, every human, their identity, their link to the Godhead by simply saying, I am, that I exist, I am. So that, when I draw it on the board in class, I have a mandala, and I put the I am in the center, and then all the spokes on the wheel. I said, this is all the different humans in the universe, and everyone is linked at the core. We're all part of this one I am. And, it just makes perfect sense, and it's another way of pretty much saying what you were saying, this how we're all linked this way.
I think
the holographic paradigm does that as well, you know.
Absolutely, I call myself the holographic physician because when I started doing this, the quantum physics, quantum vortex thing with the quantum physics tools, one of the things that was brought to me very clearly is what I call the golden grid connection. And it really is showing that each one of us is connected by this grid of golden light that extends everywhere. You know, it's not just in one dimension, it's in every dimension. And when I lead people through that meditation and they feel that connection, it's a life-changing event for them. And, you know, the deeper that they go into it, the more life-changing it is, of course. And it just reminds us, I think, of where we're from and where we're going to. And it's so important. And one thing I wanted to say, too, when you're talking about when I was in Belize, one of the things that I found very endearing about the natives there, who are mostly Rastafarians, but very, very interesting, the way they talk about God is they call God I. And they pray to I. And I always thought that was really interesting. And they, you know, sometimes they'll say Jah, but most of the time they say I. And, you know, to be with people that are deep in the jungle and to hear them talk about the Godhead and about how they do things that we would consider miracles, things that one person alone can't do as they're working their plot of land in the jungle. And I asked them, well, how do you do these things? And they said, well, I helps me. And, you know, I could not do this without I. And you just kind of go, yeah, that's true. And, you know, in our busy lives, we kind of forget that. And we forget that we live in more dimensions than just the third dimension. And we forget that the brain is out in a different dimension, or not the brain, the mind is out in a different dimension entirely. And, you know, when you mention that meditation is a state of resonance, that really resonates, pun intended, with me. Because I know that so much of who we are and what we do is a matter of frequency. And all we have to do is change our frequency to change our lives. And one of the things I've tried to get across to people through the show and through the traveling that I've done is that we can change this planet in an instant into the true paradise it was meant to be by dropping the fear and only believing in the reality of love and of higher consciousness. We just have to get enough people and, you know, enough cooks in the soup doing it.
I do think a shift took place when Obama got elected. I mean, I think everybody on the planet really felt a change. And I'm very hopeful that a positive shift has taken place on the planet.
Yeah, and I think that had to happen. Yes, I agree. I'm kind of apolitical. I mean, I know what's going on behind the scenes, and so I, you know, don't buy into the whole political thing. But I do really expect that. I know there's a lot of things Obama won't be able to do because he's really not in charge. But what we need to do,
but
all
it symbolized, of it symbolized something, you know.
Yeah.
It's when you saw the people all over the world. You saw him in Germany. 200,000 people went to see this guy. Something is happening, and I think great films can do this as well. You know, we need more enlightening movies, movies that uplift us.
Well, that comes to what you said, I think it was towards the back of the book, where you said that you have a quote there, matter is experiencing an extraordinary upsurge of intelligence, we as matter, and then the mind and the spirit. And I think that what you said there is really true. This is really the dawning of the age of consciousness for humanity. And then you also said that we're transducers and organizers of conscious energy radiating from all the stars, and that our brain arranges these myriad photons in a highly structured electrophysical space-time network. I read that and I went, yeah, I like that. That's a really nice way to explain it.
Well, one of the points I tried to make was that if you put a Hubble telescope at any point in the universe, you're going to see all the stars. So every spot in the universe really codes for every other spot. And if we could take a light from the sun and create vitamin D in our body, what are we getting from all the other stars? You know, I mean, we're getting all this energy from all over the place. There's a huge secret in the structure of light. It's a huge doorway to this enlightenment, and I think the internet also is creating a quantum shift, a positive shift. I mean, there's some negatives, obviously, but a positive shift of having the universe, the planet become more together. You know, you can email somebody in Russia or Scotland or South America or any place for no money. I mean, it doesn't cost you anything to interact all over the world, and I think that is helping. Moving us in this direction. The other thing I like is Gurdjieff's idea that our goal is to transform ourselves, is to evolve while we're alive. You know, to constantly try to make yourself a better person. And he said that's the hardest thing to do, is to change yourself. But I think that's one of the things that you're talking about, is that we have to. It is a struggle. You know, we've got to. Work in this positive direction, but just keep going in that direction. Keep working on your projects and try to make yourself more creative and be bold too. You know, reach for the stars.
Well, you talk in the book too about the spin, and you know most people know about the spin of the electrons and everything in the atom, but I think that they don't realize that we spin. And most of the time, animals and children don't see us as the humans that we see ourselves. What they see is like the cartoon of Dennis the Menace, when he's running around, he's a little tornado, and you can kind of see hair and eyes once in a while, but mostly he's just a spinning vortex, and that's actually what we look like. And what I've seen when I've seen this has been a pair of eyes, and then this white whirlwind, just a tornado with these eyes at the top of it, and lightning bolts coming out of it. And that was the healer that I was looking at the time, and it startled me so much I about fell off the table. And it was just really funny. And then I started thinking about it. And then in here you talk about how the velocity of light demarcates the boundary to the next higher dimension. And so, you know, velocity and spin and all these things, I mean, the quantum physicists are talking about the way that we spin, and there's some healers that I've had on the show that talk about the spin. And if your spin is in the wrong direction, then you're going to be gay. You know, if the spin's the other, you know, off here or there, you're going to have illness. And so what they do is they actually correct the spin. And I'm not quite sure what they're talking about personally, but that's what I have seen, and I have often wondered about that. So when I saw your line about velocity of light, I went, oh, that makes a lot of sense, because all you have to do is change your frequency somehow, change the energy to a higher state, and you're in that next dimension. You know, the physicists say we're only one-tenth of a hertz separated from the other dimensions. And this is why we're having bleed through, and we're having the, you know, more people seeing ghosts and elementals and, you know, fairies and elves and gnomes and pets and humans who have passed on and shadow people and all of these things that we didn't used to see in our modern society. So it's all making
One of the
great
things about spin that you were talking about, when I was in ninth grade, we learned that a gyroscope or electrons or protons, when they spin, they set up their own coordinates in space irrespective of the movement of the Earth. That stayed with me. That was something that I thought was hugely profound, that the movement of the Earth, there's something that supersedes that, and it's linked to spin. And I see that in a self way of working on your own projects, is staying on your own path, is not being diverted into another path. We saw a movie the other night with Meg Ryan, and she, you know, did her face. She had face surgery. She was a beautiful lady. I mean, she got off the path, you know, but she should age gracefully and stay on her own path. But someone says you need this, you need that. So I think there's, you know, there's like a dual link. In physics, it says spin sets up its own coordinates in space irrespective of the Earth. How does that apply to us? Stay on your own path, you know, work on your own self, you know, stay true to what you really want to do. So there's like these you know, different levels to these concepts that have metaphysical reasons as well as the actual physics behind it. So I try to do a bit of that in the book as well.
Yeah, I think you did a good job with that. And there are a couple other quotes I'd like to mention. We don't have much. Actually, we're a little bit over. But in there you have that energies are in bodies and act through bodies. The things once called into being for some purpose or some cause can never stay inactive of their proper energy, and that the bodies on the earth are places and organs for the energies, and the energies are immortal. And so this is really pointing out what spiritual teachers have said forever, basically. And then you have the other thing about the E equals MC squared, that energy exists not faster than the speed of light, but in a realm square to the speed of light. And since mind is some form of neuroelectric or field energy, it may also operate in a dimension square to the speed of light, photonic energy in three dimensions. You know, you've really brought something together here, Mark, that I think is turning on some light bulbs for a lot of people right now, because it's explaining something that, it's wonderful. You're explaining something that people have wondered about and couldn't quite make that connection. So thank you for doing that.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, just fun.
I tried to open a door with the book, and I know it's not an end. I really saw it as a doorway to stimulate the metaphysics people and also the physicists to try and say, yeah, we've got to include the mind, and we've got to rethink Einstein's theory, and that there's got to be something going faster than the speed of light. So that was a lot of, I mean, the quotes you said were, you know, hit the nail on the head. That's that we're operating in a realm square to the speed of light, really. E equals MC squared. I mean, mind is in a dimension square to the speed of light. I also have a little section on Uspensky, how you go from one dimension to the next dimension. So I try to show, you know, in a very logical way how we really do live in this other dimension of hyperspace or mental space.
Well, and I think the gravity thing that explains it too, where you say the gravity is ubiquitous and it falls off exponentially as it interfaces with a higher dimension, and that matter is in one dimension and spirit is in another. Oh my gosh, doesn't that explain a lot of things? You know,
yeah.
And finally, as a spiritual metaphysical scientist, I can say, I am vindicated. Finally, you know, there are so many of us that have had these, you know, for lack of a better word, you know, psychic experiences since we were kids and had to put up with the rest of the world thinking we were crazy. And
yeah.
And I had talked to Uri Geller about that, years ago, you know, briefly, and about how this really is the natural state of our being, that, you know, we're everything. So why should we limit ourselves? You know, God itself is limitless, and isn't that where we're going?
Yes, I totally agree. you know, I have a section on astrology too, where, I mean, I'm really saying, let's open the doors, let's go back to the ancients and learn from the ancients and have respect for them and what they've discovered, and try to marry that with the new findings in physics and quantum physics.
Absolutely. So, well, it's new to us. It's not new to the Tibetan Buddhists.
No,
you know,
no, not
they,
at all.
They laugh with great glee at us because now we're finally discovering what they've known for centuries.
You know, yeah, they're the top of the line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they live in quantum physics. They live utilizing the properties and the energies that we're just now discovering because of our stubbornness.
Well, one of the things is if we could get the children, you know, I'm just starting easy. So we should just study telepathy. Kids are much more open to all of this, and then they, you know, they start to close the doors on these things as J.B. Rhine's stuff is not taught in school. It should be. We should be studying these things and not fear them. Just see them as our greater potential that's unfolding. So
absolutely.
I tried hard in the book to lay the groundwork for scientists to open their eyes to metaphysics.
Yeah, and I think that you did a good job of that, and it's very important. And as one of those kids who was told that this stuff doesn't exist, until finally it didn't exist for me for quite some time, I can tell you that life is not as rich without using those extrasensory organs that we have, or those extrasensory abilities. But I also remember how scared people were when they would be thinking something and I turn around and answer them, they hadn't opened their mouths. And, you know, the bad part of it is that by losing those abilities, we can't tell when people are dangerous to us, or we can't tell when they're lying to us, or, you know, their hidden agenda. And, you know, the reality is that underneath it all, we all know what's going on. There is no hiding. But it's that conscious mind that gets in the way. And if we could just open the door to more of what the right brain is trying to tell us, you know, and all the millions of bits, I think there's 16 million bits of information that the brain processes, but we only get like 500 or something. So we're missing a lot of things, Mark.
Yeah, that's for sure. I did include, you know, a number of my own psychic experiences. I wanted the reader to know that the writer, me, has had these experiences, and I log them. And I think it's important for your listeners to keep a journal. If an amazing event happens, put it down, because you forget it. You think you remember some of these things, but you don't. And it's nice to have them down there. And also, as I said before, to keep a dream diary, because that's a really good way to interact with this higher self and listen to it. What's it telling us? It doesn't speak in the same language that it's not speaking English. It's thinking in a whole other realm and forcing us to think in this other realm. But, you know, go with it, too. It's exciting to do that, interact with this other realm and see it on paper by keeping a journal. So have you discussed having journals on your
own? Oh, yeah, I discuss that with people now and then, and my physicist friends that have been on have mentioned that too, especially Rick Miller has mentioned that to people, how important it is to keep a dream journal and to really journal what goes on in your life so that you can look back on it and realize where you've been and the progress that you've made. And that's the first thing that I tell people to do when I'm counseling them, because otherwise they don't realize how far they've come. And I even do something similar to that. I do what I call the snapshot of the physical body. When somebody comes to me for medical help, you know, I'll have them fill out this very lengthy 10-page questionnaire with repetitive questions, because it gives me a snapshot of where they're at, and then I'll have them fill it out again in a couple months, because they might think nothing happened. But the fact is there have been huge changes. And so the journal does that same thing. It allows you to take a snapshot of who you were at that moment, and then you can compare it with who you are presently. So I agree, it's extremely important, and your dreams can go anywhere from just the the brain trying to process, you know, what information it took in during the day, to actually having prophetic dreams that could save your life or the life of a loved one, to having communication with our loved ones that have passed over, to actually living in other dimensions, being cognizant of the other parts of ourselves. So, yeah, I totally agree with you.
You know, there was, back in the early 80s, I got my first computer. It was a Radio Shack. And I put it in the room, and I said, I want to remember this moment. I want to remember that this is a weird thing, that I've got a computer sitting on my desk. And if I didn't make that little mental note, you forget, because you just go through life. Everyone's got a cell phone now. You know, everyone's on the Internet. Everyone uses email. You need to, I think, spend a little bit of time with yourself and make these checkpoints where you say, I want to remember this time because it's a change that's occurred. And I want to remember that I didn't have this then, and now I have something new. Maybe it's a new house or, you know, a new person that you meet. But to log these things that way as well. And so I've tried to do that. I think that that's another important way to keep track of the changes that do occur in your life.
Absolutely. And the other thing, too, is you might have these little flashes of insight, and sometimes you get them just a piece at a time. And then all of a sudden they all come together. And so it's valuable for that too. You know, could spur another book. You never know.
Yes, it very well could.
Well, we are out of time. Boy, we could go on talking about this whole realm of consciousness forever. But listeners, you have been listening to Dr. Mark Cipher, his new book, Transcending the Speed of Light, Consciousness, Quantum Physics, and the Fifth Dimension. And I presume they can get this book at Amazon and Borders and pretty much everywhere, right, Mark?
Yes, and thank you very much for having me on the show. I enjoyed very, very much talking to you.
Oh, bet. You bet. I enjoyed it, too. And why don't you go ahead and give your website?
Okay, it's just my name, markcipher.com, markcipher.com. There's an email address, too, if people want to say hello to me.
Yeah, people can buy your books there, too. And one of these days, I would like to have you back, Mark, to talk about your book on Tesla, too, because I know a lot of the listeners are really fascinated with Tesla. And so if it's okay with you, you know, we'll talk about doing another show on the Tesla book.
Yes, that would be great. The name of the book is Wizard, and I'd love to talk about Tesla.
Cool. Well, we'll have to schedule that. So I'll have to email you on that. I've got to go look at the schedule and stuff. So thank you so much for being on tonight, Mark. It's been a great pleasure. And I wish you a lot of success with your book. And I'm interested to see what the next one is going to be like.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You bet. Okay, and listeners, thank you so much for tuning in. You know, you guys are extremely important to me because without you, there would be no point. So thank you for listening, as always. And please do check out HydraMay Skin Nutrition if you haven't yet. Go to HydraMay.com, and you can see the other products that are available. And I recommend it highly, not just because they are the sponsor of the show, but also because it works. And I love stuff that works. And that's about it for tonight, I think. So everybody's saying, yep, that was a super fast hour. Yes, it was, and it was fun. So until next week, be happy, be healthy, and be who you really are. Nighty-night.
Day with each your soul to keep. Come, my children. children time to awake from your sleep. Rise to a new day with each your soul to keep.